somewhere I read, of the freedom of speech.
Et qui défendait la liberté d'expression.
The moment you limit free speech, it's not free speech.
Somebody will say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. These are foolish people.
Welcome to Clear and Present Danger, a history of free speech, by Jakub Mshangama.
Clear and Present Danger relies on the generous support of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, Fridor, and the Politiken Foundation.
Episode 25. A special edition from the Oslo Freedom Forum. Today's episode is going to be a radical departure from the chronological timeline of the general podcast so far. I'm currently in Oslo for the annual Oslo Freedom Forum, a unique gathering of human rights and democracy activists from all over the world, gathered to connect, share ideas, and build alliances to strengthen freedom and undermine authoritarianism. So I've decided to take advantage of this gathering of brilliant minds to do a number of expert opinions on current cutting-edge topics related to free speech. I hope you listeners will forgive the rather abrupt break from the general arch of the show and appreciate the opportunity to listen to some of the smartest minds out there today. And for those of you who have followed along since ancient Athens, I'm sure that the historical context will only serve to enrich present-day issues. And of course, once I'm back from Oslo, I'll revert to the timeline and pick off where we left. In his book, A History of Freedom of Thought, the British-Irish historian J.B. Bury wrote,
"At present in most civilized countries, freedom of speech is taken as a matter of course and seems a perfectly simple thing. We are so accustomed to it that we look on it as a natural right. But this right has been acquired only in recent times, and the way to its attainment has lain through lakes of blood."
That was in 1912, before the Russian Revolution. Fascism and the Third Reich plunged the world into new and deeper lakes of blood that had to be overcome to pave the way for an unprecedented growth of global democracy and free speech in the second half of the 20th century and the first decade of the 21st. But the rise and rise of free speech and democracy has been halted and even reversed. Is free speech about to drown in yet new lakes of blood, or is this idea sufficiently robust to survive and thrive? With me to discuss this question is none other than Larry Diamond, who is Professor of Political Science and Sociology at Stanford University and a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. He's the author of several books, including the forthcoming Ill Winds, Saving Democracy from Russian Rage, Chinese Ambition, and American Complacency. Larry, thanks so much for agreeing to speak with me today. You and I have both been attending this Oslo Freedom Forum for years, and it's impossible to come away from this place without renewed optimism about the future of democracy and freedom when you meet all the amazing people here. But in actual fact, the Oslo Freedom Forum is a safe space for freedom in an increasingly hostile world, because for more than a decade, democracy and freedom have been in retreat, and we've witnessed what you have coined a democratic recession. Can you describe this recession both in terms of scale and consequences?
Well, thank you, Jakub. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I think you have captured well the dilemma we face, that there are an extraordinary number of very brave and courageous and outspoken activists, intellectuals, journalists, dissidents, who are trying to stand up for free expression and freedom more generally, and are facing a growing array of risks in doing so. So the key elements of the democratic recession are that the forward momentum of freedom and democracy in the world, essentially, which had been really remarkable during the 1980s and, of course, reached explosive proportions with the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union and the, quote, second liberation of sub-Saharan Africa. This great burst of democratic progress in the 1980s and 90s continued a bit into the early years of the 21st century, but really ground to a halt around 2007 or so. And increasingly in the last decade, we've seen a greater number of democratic failures than democratic transitions, the decline and really demise of democracy in some very big and important strategic states, including in the early years, Venezuela and Russia, more recently during this period of democratic recession, Turkey, Hungary, Bangladesh. We have other countries like Poland and the Philippines where democracy is in retreat and I think really hanging from a thread now. And more generally, freedom is under pressure there is less tolerance for pluralism and dissent. The rise of right-wing, illiberal, nativist populism in Europe and in the United States, and increasing polarization in the advanced industrial democracies, so people are not even willing to listen to one another, which gets us into problems of freedom of speech that are a bit more subtle but nevertheless disturbing, including, as you know, freedom of speech on university campuses.
Yes, and sort of trying to link the democratic recession to free speech more specifically. So as part of my research for this podcast, I think one of the lessons that I take with me is just how closely connected democracy and freedom of expression are, going back all the way to ancient Athens and the birth of democracy and free and equal speech. And if you look at the numbers, for instance, from Freedom House on freedom of the press, freedom of the press declined worldwide to its lowest point in 13 years in 2017. So, if I'm not mistaken, a mere 13% of the world's population enjoys a free press as categorized by Freedom House. 41% are in partly free and 46% in not free media environments. 2018 saw 251 journalists jailed, which is one of the highest numbers on record. So why does the decline in press freedom seem to go hand in hand with the democratic recession?
Well, I think for several reasons. The first reason is that there is an intimate relationship between freedom of the press and other basic freedoms on the one hand and democracy on the other. And it works this way. Not all democracies do a good job of protecting freedom of speech and freedom of the press. But no regime that does a good job of that is a non-democracy.
Yeah.
So democracy is a necessary but not sufficient condition for having healthy, vigorous levels of free expression, not only by constitutional guarantee, but in reality. And then we see the assault on freedom of expression, and particularly on independent media, as one of the early steps, one of the early warning signs of a broader campaign against liberal democracy. It's one of the first things to go in a country like Russia, like Venezuela, in the 1990s and early 2000s, like Hungary more recently, like Turkey, which has got, I think, the highest number of murdered journalists of any country in the world, one of the highest in terms of journalists in prison. And, you know, once you have neutered freedom of the press and then intimidated freedom of expression more broadly on university campuses, on the streets, in think tanks, and so on, you've got freer rein to abuse power and concentrate it and intimidate and arrest opposition and then basically progressively, step by step, destroy democracy. And in my book, I identify a 12-step program of authoritarian assault on democracy. And almost always, one of the first steps is the assault on and the legal assault on and the rhetorical denigration of independent media.
Yeah. It's so interesting because all the way back to 411 BC, when the Athenian democracy was overthrown by these oligarchs, what happened first was that Democrats were targeted. There's a very brilliant description of this in Aristotle's. It's also an almost obsessive idea for many Enlightenment thinkers like Montesquieu, but also James Madison. There's this idea of freedom of expression as the bulwark of liberty, which is the enemy of tyranny, which is why tyrants will always try to do away with freedom of expression, freedom of the press, to subvert and undermine liberty. Quite a striking historical constant, it seems to me, that free speech.
Well, there's a logic behind it.
Yeah.
You know, if you disempower, disable, silence, and ultimately arrest or eliminate the most passionate advocates of democracy and dispersal of power, scrutiny and accountability, then the way is clear for concentration and abuse of power.
So some have compared the reemergence of illiberal or authoritarian populism with the totalitarian ideologies that devastated Europe and democracy in the first half of the 20th century. But when it comes to limiting, stifling freedom of expression, it seems that modern autocrats are more sophisticated, at least in Europe. So Russia's Putin does not operate a system of gulags, for instance, in Hungary. Orban doesn't really jail or kill his critics, but still dissent, criticism, and civil society is stifled in Russia, in Hungary, and so on. So what are the new tactics in the dictator's playbook when it comes to censorship and repression?
So I'll address that in a moment, but let me appeal strongly to all of us as analysts, as citizens, as journalists, as thinkers, for real precision in analysis. Hungary is not Russia. Turkey is, is not Nazi Germany. So we need to make careful distinctions. And if we don't do so, we can't develop the fine-grained tools and the credibility of analysis that will enable us to compare countries and also to track the decay of freedom over time within a country. The early tools of this process start out in a subtle way, and they involve the rhetorical abuse of journalists as fake news, as partisan, as ill-motivated, as unprofessional, and ultimately as unpatriotic. Once you've softened up the media and disillusioned the public with the media as nothing but a bunch of selfish, cynical, unpatriotic elites, then you've paved the way for the next step of assault, which is to take away the independence of the media. This happens, first of all, by closing down publications, and second of all, by creating new publications that are slavishly loyal to the regime. The closing down in the early years doesn't happen by law. It happens through pretty clever and sophisticated means of commercial conquest. So you can weaken a media enterprise, whether print or electronic, pretty seriously by going after its advertising revenue. The state itself is often a major source of advertising revenue. So if the state on political grounds starts withdrawing all of its advertising from certain print media or certain radio or television stations, that it identifies as critical. That's the first hit. Then the state goes after the independence of business generally and says to independent businessmen and women, well, do you want to keep functioning? You know, we have these tax records on you, and it seems you haven't fully paid your taxes in previous years. Do you want to keep getting government contracts? Then, you know, if you want to keep functioning, you better play ball. And playing ball means a few key things. First of all, of course, you fund our party and not the opposition parties. And secondly, you no longer advertise in media that we deem unfriendly, unpatriotic. So then you've denied hostile media, hostile in the eyes of the ruling party, really any source of revenue. And they just shrivel up, they become weakened, and then your business cronies buy them up, and they become mouthpieces for the leader and the ruling party and the government of the day. Then you take over public broadcasting, if it existed before, and you destroy its independence, and you turn it, as Orban has, into a crude mouthpiece of the government. When you're done with all this, there's not much left. You know, the ruling party either owns and controls pretty much directly through its own organs or its business cronies, most of the key media in print, radio, and television. And the ones that remain independent are very mindful that if they cross too many lines, they could be put completely out of business as well. So that's how they go about it. They don't need to just, you know, send the stormtroopers in and close them down. They always use the facade of legal means and of commercial means to mask the crude ambitions they have to silence independent investigation and independent thought and opinion.
We saw perhaps with these secret recordings of a leader of the Austrian Freedom Party, where he thought he was in discussion with the daughter of a Russian oligarch about how to take over a leading newspaper in Austria and basically make it the mouthpiece of this political party.
I mean, that is a perfect example of, of what happens. And the reason why I think this guy's finished in Austria is because the conversation had such an obvious ring of authenticity to it. This is really what happens.
Yeah. There also seems to be a crackdown, for instance, in Russia and Hungary with NGOs trying to label them as sort of enemies of the state through different NGO laws where they have to register as foreign agents or the like.
Right. So the first target is the media. And once you have conquered and subjugated the media, the next target is usually the judiciary, because the judiciary in a democratic society, if it's independent, will defend the independence of the media and the rights to speak and oppose and expose and investigate of non-governmental organizations and civil society networks. So you really have to conquer or neuter the judiciary as well. Once you've done those two things, you as an aspiring autocrat working through the mechanisms of what used to be a liberal democracy have much freer rein to intimidate and really pretty thoroughly subdue civil society.
So until maybe 4 or 5 years ago, everyone hailed social media and technology as the new tools that will connect the world based on openness and the sharing of information. You know, if you go back and look at how Twitter and Facebook were portrayed during the Arab Spring, they were sort of the heroes. But today, social media companies have become villains and the internet is being closely regulated, both in democracies and authoritarian states. So on balance, do you think the internet has benefited freedom and democracy, or has it been reverse engineered and manipulated to such an extent as to serve the interest of authoritarians?
Well, ever since social media emerged early in the 21st century, there have been some elements of both going on simultaneously. I think in the first 5 to 8 years of the heyday of social media tools and platforms, up through, say, around 2011-12, the Arab Spring, the balance was positive. It looked like social media and related digital tools were leveling the playing field, literally in electoral politics, including in the United States. Without social media, Barack Obama would not have been elected president of the United States. There's no way he could have overcome the advantages of Hillary Clinton, who had a massive head start in the Democratic primary. And without social media, the Arab Spring, as you know, wouldn't have happened. We wouldn't have had some of the other protests, including the Occupy movements, Occupy Central in Hong Kong, the Sunflower Movement in Taiwan, many other movements like that. But I'd say in the last 5 to 8 years, the balance has turned not only negative, but I think alarmingly and decisively negative, not permanently negative, but powerfully negative. And that is because of several factors. Number one, authoritarian regimes have become more adroit at managing the internet, censoring the internet, filtering the internet, acquiring internet filtration technology from regimes like China, and also monitoring the expression and even behavior of their citizens. So that's a second element, that people are losing privacy and are more subject to being monitored, both by the state of their country and by the major commercial internet platforms, which are sometimes compelled under dubious circumstances to hand over their data to an illiberal or authoritarian government. And the third element is the proactive element of state intervention in social media, the disinformation, the trolling, the doxing, the various methods by which powerful actors and increasingly powerful state actors are disempowering and subverting both their own civil societies and in particular, democratic politics, democratic political organization, and civil society actors within other democracies, including, alarmingly, the advanced industrial democracies. So it's a new era where I think the technical momentum, the creativity, the power and the impact have lain more with authoritarian regimes than with Democrats.
In the past 5 or 6 years, I would say liberal democracies have contributed to the global decline of free speech protections by adopting increasingly draconian laws against terrorists and hate speech, even fake news, and trying to curb illegal content on the internet. One example is the German Network Enforcement Act, which forces social media companies to remove illegal content within 24 hours or face huge fines. And recently, the leader of the German Christian Democrats, Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer, or AKK, suggested online censorship after a German YouTube star made this viral video which criticized the CDU for its supposedly lack of action on climate change. But what's the significance of liberal democracies sort of restricting freedom of expression?
Well, the potential significance is that if they really go ahead and do this on the scale that is implied by the German law and by other laws that liberal democracies are passing or considering, which in some cases, as you know, are even worse than the German law, then the only governmental advocates of freedom of expression will have been compromised. A further implication, as you know, is that authoritarian states are being emboldened when they see Germany passing a law like this. Their eyes light up with tremendous enthusiasm and an instant recognition of the gift that has been given to them by having a prominent liberal democracy adopt this kind of law. Then they can simply import it wholesale, as they've done, as we were talking about earlier.
Yes, in places like Russia, Vietnam, the Philippines, Honduras, Malaysia, Singapore.
And then how can the liberal democracies possibly complain? Because they will say, we're only copying a prominent European democracy. Now, that said, with concern and even alarm registered, it also needs to be acknowledged, I think, that some kind of regulation is necessary, some kind of mindfulness about content moderation is necessary. This is not just the street where anyone can go out and speak from the corner in Hyde Park and say whatever they want. The great internet platforms, Facebook in particular, Twitter, YouTube, and so on, these are publishers, and they have a certain responsibility for the content that they publish. And I think we need to be extremely cautious and sparing about imposing draconian regulations to compel them to moderate their content, because the more draconian the regulations, the more the companies will over-moderate, over-censor, in order to avoid making a mistake that could cost them a lot of money. It doesn't cost them as much money to censor a particular comment that might be in doubt as it might to pay the fine that results from it. So we need to be sensitive to that, but we also need to recognize that there are also threats to freedom of speech that are emanating from, and to freedom more generally, including freedom from physical danger, that are emanating from the unfettered ability of militant actors and authoritarian states like Russia to pour any type of content at all onto these internet platforms, no matter how egregiously untrue or violently explosive it may be. Violently insightful, it may be. So just as you can't walk into a theater, I'm sorry to visit upon you probably the most hackneyed analogy that you hear on your podcast.
Yeah, the old Oliver Wendell Holmes shouting fire.
So there've got to be some kind of minimal rules. If they're not minimal, and if they're not enforced with a great sense of sensitivity and restraint, you're sliding down the dangerous slope towards state censorship. If they're not there at all, you're going to invite much more indiscriminate state censorship as a result of the violence and hate and bloody polarization that are going to be catalyzed by the unleashing of extreme manipulation of the internet for cynical and authoritarian ends.
In his 1941 State of the Union speech, Franklin Delano Roosevelt launched his vision of a world order based on four freedoms. And the first one was freedom of speech and expression everywhere in the world. But the current U.S. president seemed to have no such ambitions and is happy to gloss over the killing of an American-based Saudi journalist, Jamal Khashoggi, and generally seems quite comfortable with strongman authoritarians who stifle dissent. So has America abandoned its commitment to global free speech norms? And if so, what does that mean for freedom of speech and freedom in general?
I don't think the United States of America has abandoned its commitment to freedom generally and to freedom of speech and freedom of the media specifically. These remain norms that I think are precious to at least a majority of the American public, and by and large, deeply valued by the United States Congress. In addition, it is the case, however, that we have a president of the United States, unfortunately, who has shown great contempt for these norms and no behavioral or rhetorical appreciation for their importance and their centrality in American tradition, not only, not to mention the broader liberal democratic traditions. And so then the question is, well, how important is Donald Trump for the United States of America and its behavior? And the answer is, we are a presidential system, and presidents are very important. And more to the point, the symbolic damage that is done by having a president of the United States declare the media to be fake news, treasonous, hostile to him.
Enemies of the people.
Enemies of the people, unimportant. The symbolic value of this to authoritarians around the world who are repeating his language about fake news and enemies of the people is very great, is very, very damaging.
I think Committee to Protect Journalists, their latest report on jailed journalists, I think showed, I believe, 21 or 28 journalists in prison for spreading false information, which is like the highest ever recorded. So, you might not impute that directly to the influence of Donald Trump.
Well, and I don't know if it's Reporters Without Borders or Freedom House or whatever, but one of these monitoring organizations has kept account of the number of autocrats who have been aping Donald Trump's language in carrying out these crackdowns on independent journalists. And it's a significant and growing number of autocrats who are using the words of the President of the United States as justification for their authoritarian behavior against freedom of expression and freedom of the press.
Some experts and historians have pointed to the Helsinki Final Act of 1976 as contributing to the fall of the Soviet bloc because it committed, on paper at least, communist states to respect freedom of speech and religion, which could then be used to delegitimize authoritarian rulers by dissidents like the Charter of 77 in Czechoslovakia, Sakharov in Russia, and so on. Do you see any inspiration for democracy activists in these past precedents, or do we need completely new strategies to reverse the decline in democracy and free speech?
Well, I think the final Helsinki Act was extremely important in giving us tools to mobilize against assaults on freedom in the communist space, and to give hope and inspiration and legitimacy to dissidents behind the Iron Curtain that were campaigning for freedom of expression and basic political rights. So I think it's a model that remains extremely important. And I think it underscores how precious norms are, written, codified, mutually agreed upon regional and international norms, how important they are to the advance of and defense of freedom around the world. We ignore norms at our peril, and I think we've got to fight to re-codify them, re-embrace them, invoke them whenever possible. This is part of the vulnerability of authoritarian regimes, that these norms exist and can be utilized to hold these regimes accountable.
Larry, thank you so much for your time. This was excellent.
Okay, thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you.